previously in part one.
I saw 30 of my best mates that I've known since I was 6 years old. So, but if it's just part of what's happening, you never have to overcome it because your opinion of it is, it just is.
Back to what we said earlier about being the role model piece, because you said that when you're playing at Dorking and the Colts 17, 18 year olds looking up to you being like, I'd love to be that one day. Absolutely. And you lose that from not playing. It must be amazing. I spoke to Lauren earlier on and she mentioned the role model thing. And I said, it's so poignant because there, you just said it, to have what you've gone through now and to have kids as young as five say that they look up to you, having gone through everything you've gone through, it's amazing that role model piece is then replaced.
And it's funny because I never intended it, obviously, to be a role model piece. And like, I set out on to do the row to satisfy a sense of adventure and to do something big and majestic. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I'm hugely competitive, so I wanted to win the solo race. I ended up not winning the solo race because various reasons, the competency of sailing the boat and a bit of weather routing, etc. Which I've never done before. And using metrics of success and reframing what you measure success by. So I could have the metrics of success that I was thinking about for the whole campaign were winning and a nice time. As in getting a nice short time, having a nice time. Of course, having a nice time. Having a nice time was actually should have been higher on my agenda. So actually, that's poignant. So a quick time was annoyingly higher for me than a nice time. But then, of course, raising money for the British Heart Foundation, which I'm still doing, and the ability to raise awareness for a cause. So in the right order, it was I wanted to win the solo race, have a crack at the world record if weather conditions allowed. I mean, it's always churlish to say stuff like that because especially the weather conditions have
over that long a period as well.
No idea what's going to happen. Then raise money for the British Heart Foundation, and then sort of like that awareness piece, which I didn't quite know how it was going to fit, sort of came last in that sort of motivational piece, so like of how I was deriving motivation for finishing the row.
Yeah.
But then as having a nice time and the sort of winning of the race with the record time disappeared, I then realized that actually I do value that I hate the idea of it being inspirational, but the confidence piece that other people had gained confidence from doing, from seeing what I had done, and therefore that has been now the metrics of success for me, is like hearing that this person has. I had a lady at a talk the other day who said, I had a heart operation and I just decided I was going to stay in bed for 2 months. I then saw you row the Atlantic and I got out of bed and came to this talk.
That's
all you need.
It just gives you goosebumps to hear those sort of stuff, and it's super gratifying to hear those sorts of things.
I want to go into the whole rowing thing because I just find it bananas that you've done 3,000 miles in 44 days in 1 hour. What did the actual preparation go into that? Like, was it years preparing? Was it like nutritional stuff? Was it, you were rowing 3-4 times a week? What actually did it look like? Because people just see the finished article and they never see what's actually behind it.
Yeah, so I signed up to the row in December 2020. And so there were 3 years then of preparation, and I actually didn't originally think I'd do it as a solo. So Fraser, the guy who owns the gym that I go to, is an ex British rower. So he rowed in the World Championships for Great Britain, and he's 6'7". I thought, perfect, good mate, 6'7", British rower. Do you want to row the Atlantic, mate?
And he's stupid enough to say yes.
And then he was like, yeah, sounds like a good plan. And then quickly I was like, most people do it as a two or a four, right? So I was like, then we were chatting to other people in the gym. Reese, a chap in the gym who rode at Henley for Molesey and won Henley, he would be perfect to sign up. And then Nico, another friend who had penny farthings to the Alps, so like incredibly resilient, like had done 3 marathons back to back with no training, like bit stupid, but but really resilient. And so we immediately had this team of four. And then I inquired with the race as to what the process was, and they're like, there's a wait list for 3 years. And I sort of had got this the inception of the idea of rowing the Atlantic in September of that year.
So getting
it
going
straight away. And I was obsessed with it. I was I could not get the idea out of my head. I dreamt about waves every time I sort of thought about the Atlantic. And then with that 3-year wait list, I thought, how am I going to keep these three people as motivated as myself? And then what is going to be the story of the campaign? I mean, the campaign costs about £130,000 to run, including the purchase of a boat.
Mm.
And I thought, how am I going to model this campaign? How am I going to differentiate myself from the other 39 boats in the race? So, I mean, there's nearly £5 million required to start the race just from raising money for the boats. And I thought, what's going to be my point of difference? And then realised that Man with Pacemaker Rose Atlantic for the British Heart Foundation is quite a good tagline, and therefore corporates would get on board for understanding that motivation. So, and then doing that solo. So then I came up with the charity. I then started to run the whole campaign through, started a charity called Wave Wrangler. So the idea of getting my waves under, the waves of my ECG under control, waves of the ocean under control. But didn't quite know.
Name.
Thanks. love a play on words. didn't quite know what the real motives of the charity was going to be. So then realised that if I was going to raise a lot of money, I might as well give it to the number one heart charity in the UK that fund £450 million worth of research into heart. Jesus. Yeah, into heart care. And so working with them also for the PR aspect rather than me sort of trying to flag just for Wave Wrangler. And also, look, I'm a startup charity. Are people going to give money to a startup charity? So, talk to British Heart Foundation. And then eventually have come up also with the idea for Wave Wrangler to fund defibrillators in underfunded sports centres. I mean, Dorking Rugby Club, our bus driver had a sudden cardiac arrest after getting off the bus from a away journey. And our physio saved his life with a defibrillator.
Really?
Someone has had a sudden cardiac arrest and his life was saved with a defibrillator. Awesome. So of course, that if you're awesome. a rugby club with a bit of cash or a gym with a bit of cash, then of course you're going to spend money on a defibrillator or should spend money. But if you're a grassroots boxing gym or football club that doesn't have a lot of cash, you're going to spend money on pads or coaches or footballs, not necessarily defibrillators.
They're also very expensive as well in the grand scheme of things, aren't they?
£2,000. Yeah. And so Wave Wrangler will continue past my campaign, which raised money for the British Heart Foundation.
That's awesome. That's brilliant. Yeah,
let's go to before you get on the boat. What was going on in your head? Were you just like, I'm ready now? Or was it like,
I go back to prep. So 3 years of basically the first piece of prep that you have to do is raise enough cash to fund the boat. And so purchase of a boat. I spoke to Mark Schlatz, who holds the world record for solos and pairs. Sailed around the world solo twice, and I found
that's just nuts.
Yeah,
that's nuts.
Also, did it as part of the Golden Globe, which is the same technology that they had in the 70s. So, no sat phones, no GPS. Yeah,
beast.
Yeah,
just him and
him. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's completely nuts.
What does that do to you mentally as well?
He's completely nuts.
That's not a problem.
This is a guy who won a kickboxing tournament in Australia at the age of 19, bought a boat with the money, but then didn't have enough money to train, to do the training. So then he just sailed the boat back and learned on the way with a manual.
What a lunatic. What a lunatic.
I envy people out of the way. It's just so spontaneous.
It's so spontaneous. So 3 years of prep was firstly financial and the logistics, speaking to Mark, got a boat designed. He was designing a new boat, so I didn't want to do things traditionally. There's a boat building company that nearly do all the boats and have got sort of 1,000 crossing under their belt. So Mark was building a new boat, so ended up going with him in a carbon fiber boat. I mean, it's a really long story, but it didn't get delivered until the July of 2023. So ideally, I wanted 2 summers in it, but only ended up with 2 months in it. So physical prep was What I sort of focused on. It's something that you can control. Mm. Obviously, the I couldn't control that I didn't have a boat, and therefore I could have tried. But I could control my physical training. So I did 3 years of working with a PT who specifically designs programs for ocean rowers. So obviously, as a solo rower, if you get injured, it's not the ideal because there's no one to row.
What happens then if you do? Are there boats out there checking in on you?
No,
nothing.
No.
So you're just lying there. You're just stuck.
Yeah. You blow there eventually.
Wherever you end up.
So getting injured is not a good idea. So like making sure my like joints were robust. So like I had a lot of like hip preparation, knee preparation, ankle preparation, core like stability work. Along with a lot of like zone two work. So like low heart rate stuff, which then builds. I guess it's physical resilience because the ability to row 2 hours on, 2 hours off for 44 days is what you're aiming to do. So I ended up not rowing. The traditional ocean rowing pattern of work to rest is 2 hours on, 2 hours off as a pair or a four. That fits in quite nicely. As a solo, one of the greatest things is you can do whatever you want when you want. Also one of the worst things because
you're on your own doing
because you're not accountable to anyone else obviously. So I ended up rowing 3 hours on, 1 hour off during the day, and then for the beginning bit I'd take a whole 4 hours off at night, and then when it got a bit tough I did 2 hours on, 2 hours off at night through like
when it got a bit tough. He says that's mad.
Mate, that is mental.
And so physical preparation and then I also did a bit of psychological preparation. I worked with a company called Matrix Performance who specialise in resilience performance. So the idea of performing to a high level under duress. They work with, they're still in the RAF, PTIs in the RAF, who design resilient performance programmes for Eurofighter pilots.
Unbelievable.
And so worked on a lot of models of motivation and getting to know myself. It's almost like going through therapy so that you're not on the in the middle of the Atlantic discovering stuff about yourself and what you find important. But that was hugely valuable.
When you're out there, was there any point where you were like, I'm very lonely, this is weird, like almost not lose your head, but almost like 44 days on your own, not really speaking to many people, like what's that like?
It's weird. Like, so on day three, I cried every day. But most of it was happy crying, like realization that people cared about this. So I had a WhatsApp group that ended up with nearly 300 people in it that were talking about me on the row nearly every day. And I then speak to one person every day who was in that group. And they'd give me feedback about what people were saying and who was saying what. And I actually think I was less lonely on the Atlantic than I have been since I've come back.
That's really interesting.
Because in the middle of the Atlantic, you don't see any. You know you're not going to see anyone, and anyone you aren't. If you ring, and you know that if you ring someone and they're going to answer, if they don't answer, it doesn't matter. But if they do answer, they want to speak to you because you're like this is cool, he's in the middle of the Atlantic. I am speaking to someone in the middle of the Atlantic. And obviously I'd ring one person every day and they would be really interested in speaking to me. You come back and there's lots of people to ring, there's lots of opportunity to do things, but you actually don't know who wants to speak to you ever.
Okay.
And so like, you let's say you've got a Saturday free and you're like, whoa, I've got so many different options here, but I don't want to bother that person. And so, it wasn't lonely because I knew that people were thinking about me or wanted to speak to me at that point in time. I think it's harder when you don't know and there's all those options to see people, but yet you can't do that. So yes, I'd have a free Saturday on the Atlantic, but my only option was to row, right? Or like talk to the bird that like flew past, which I did every day.
I'm not surprised.
At no point did I think I was lonely. I was like, this is something I'm doing, and at no point did I regret anything. I found it hard at times, and then at some points I found it hard that I wasn't winning the solo race, and then had to like reframe my motivation and understand why I'd lost motivation, which is like a bit of the work I did with Matrix to understand like the model of self-determination theory. So the idea that to be fully self-determined, you need that autonomy, the competency and relatedness. So like feeling part of a community. So that autonomy piece, I knew I'd lost that autonomy because the weather was terrible. It wasn't helping me in any way, but I couldn't control that weather. I also lost sort of control of some of my electrics because batteries weren't charging. So that I then had to work out which of my electrics I was prioritizing, i.e. making water, which is obviously more important than steering. But at the same time, because...
You need to know where you're going.
Because of the auto helm, as a solo rower, the auto helm is like one of your biggest crutches. So you can just row and that steers you in the right direction with the course. But of course, water is keeping me alive. but I wanted the auto helm because if I turned it off, then I wouldn't be able to make as quick progress. And if I wanted to win the race, I would need my auto helm, but I also need water to keep it up. And so that was that loss of autonomy, saying today actually you're just going to have to surf and hand steer to like turn everything off, which meant I probably didn't make as quick a progress as I would have done had I been
sacrificed for something else.
But at least I managed to drink or have a liter and a half of water, which still wasn't enough for like that day.
Yeah.
So that loss of autonomy that I realized, and then realized that what can I control that will make me feel a little bit more motivated, as opposed to trying to control the weather or the electrics or just understanding that mm-hmm. dynamic. The competency is, I prepared so well physically, and I was probably the strongest, most physically fit person in the race, but it means very little. And so the competency, I'd focused on the wrong things when actually I should have learned how to like live on the boat a bit better mm-hmm. and have a better routine as to eating and rowing and sticking to that routine, so that I established what routine worked better for me. I know they say that it's not the routine that doesn't work for you, it's the you didn't work for the routine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, finding a routine that is a little bit easier to stick to rather than rowing for 3 hours, 1 hour, 3 hours on, 1 hour off, didn't necessarily work for me. And the food didn't work for me also because I was dehydrated, so I couldn't eat as much dry food as I couldn't eat as much food because I was only having dry food rather than wet food. So the routine didn't work for me in that respect. And then the relatedness, of course, I'm in the middle of the Atlantic on my own, but then realizing that I got one text message from my weather router that says, do this course and the weather's going to be like this, this and this for the next 3 days. And the number of days I was like, the weather is not like this. Guys. And they were in Holland, a bit of a language barrier, so I'd ring them on the sat phone and it was just, this relatedness was lost. And like, no insult to them, but it was just like, there was this like disconnect that I didn't feel like that we were a team.
Yeah.
And so I ended up giving my brother a trigonometry lesson from the Atlantic.
Oh, God. Dehydrated.
Yeah, dehydrated. In the middle of nowhere. Yeah, trying to like shout at my younger brother, being like, come on, it's like Sokotoa, don't you remember? to tell me how far like east or west the guy in first place was, and Liz, who was behind me, like who was, so she's sailed 600,000 nautical miles that's like around the world like than 30 times, and so her like knowledge of the sea is better than anyone else's in the world probably. She's like the number one female skipper, and so she was really using the weather to her advantage. She was like, I think she got the most the biggest day in terms of miles out of any of the solo rowers. She did like over 100 miles and she was chasing me. So like with Henry bringing that in, I got that relatedness and sort of felt that there was this sort of team spirit again,
fueled something back into you
and fueled that motivation. So I like spoke to him every day on text message, and that was, and so understand that toolbox of autonomy, competency and relatedness, whilst it like sounds awfully like self-help, it is. It's like, what is this toolbox that I could use for motivation, and what am I missing, and what control can I regain over this motivational piece to try and be happier.
So it sounds to me like the psychological battle you had far outweighed the physical one. The physical one was obviously really tough, but the preparation you'd had prepare you for that amount of rowing, whereas the psychological thing, nothing can prepare you for that. What was that like?
It was good. At the same time, I then could look back and think, I'm so glad I'm this physically prepared, because otherwise I'd have that to contend with as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I'd never say to anyone, don't prepare as much physically, because there are times when I'm like pulling the boat and like every stroke felt like 150 kg deadlift.
Going and I'm backwards.
Like, I'm really happy that I'm this strong. I'm like, I hope people, like, I hope no one else is struggling. No, like, genuinely, like, I was like, how is like, yeah. Anyway, so that was happy. I was happy that I'd prepared physically.
Sure.
And actually, I didn't find it hard physically. And that sounds terrible. But like, I only lost 5 kilos of weight. And like, I managed to eat enough. But it was and I don't think it's the psychological thing that I expected. So like, it wasn't the, oh, I'm lonely, I'm at sea, oh, this is really far, like, I'm scared because I'm stuck in the middle of the Atlantic. It was more the inability to stay present, because I was too worried about winning. and
hindsight of that.
The reflection for me is I look back on it and think, why on earth did you care so much about winning? Like, you're just crossing the Atlantic. It's still pretty, like, I come back and people can't get their head around the fact that, like, I'm upset that I came second. Like,
yeah, like, that's your inner athlete in you, though.
Of course.
It's kind of been bred in you.
I'm just very competitive. And so people are like, you did really well. You crossed the Atlantic. I was like, yeah, but...
yeah, but I didn't win.
But I didn't win.
And so this is then goes back into, like, the reframing and what metric of success I'm using to, like, try and keep some sanity and sort of reflect positively on the whole campaign. Is now the work that I'm doing with the British Heart Foundation,
which is amazing,
that inspirational piece, which I find incredibly important, and I'm so glad that it's there to, like, fill that void of not coming first.
Hi guys, I hope you enjoyed part two. First and foremost, if you are across YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe and do comment below. It really, really helps the channel out loads. Here's what you can expect in part three. Enjoy. Well, as long as you remember, you can remember always wanted to win everything you did.
The journey that, like, that 3 years has been, I think that growth mindset, fixed mindset piece is.